Kevin.
Thank you very much, Abe. What I wanted to do is just give a little context. There's been a lot of discussion in the last 5 years about what is and what is not in the quote-unquote Iraqi documents archive. So I want to give a little bit of context, and I want to, by way of outline here, a little bit of background into the nature of this kind of work briefly. And I'm going to talk very specifically about the content of the archive as it's currently instantiated, and that through a program sponsored by Dr. Mankin's office, OSD Policy Planning, is to look at a methodology by which that archive can be made available to scholars broadly, in keeping with the Secretary's guidance that it be open, unclassified, and research available for multidisciplinary work across all the fields that have been discussed here today. First of all, this isn't the first time that we've captured the archives of an adversary state, or we have in our possession the archives of an enemy actor. And I want to hit on three very distinct cases real quickly. First was the first major case was the Civil War. And the reason I'm going to hit each of these, I want to show you some parallels and some continuity in the issues and challenges that I'm going to talk about in a minute. At the end of the Civil War, certainly with the collapse of Richmond, we captured a lot of the archives, the records from the Confederate government. Those came into the possession of the War Department. A lot of confusion on what the value is, what should we do with them, and there was a lot of people running around collecting souvenirs. Great autograph hunters were right on the heels of the Army grabbing documents out of Richmond. So they had this giant pile. They thought, well, there'll be some use for it in the future, and then President Lincoln is assassinated. And harkening back to some of the issues right on the cusp of the collapse of Baghdad, there was a feeding frenzy that the answer to the solution on who in the Confederate hierarchy actually ordered the assassination of President Lincoln ensued. And for about 6 months in the press and in the War Department, a frenzy of piling and digging through the archives of the Confederacy to find the magic answer to the great question of the age, which was who actually authorized John Wilkes Booth to do his dirty deed. And of course, they never found anything. That wasn't part of the actual history of the event. But it didn't slow down the frenzy of activity, and the rumors of what might have been persisted for 40, 50 years. You can still read about it in histories written in the 50s. The next time we had a major, and by the way, that resulted in the long run in one of the greatest historical collections of any war, with 128-volume history of the rebellion that took 40 years to produce, but no real Civil War scholar worth his salt could work without them today. You go into the Spanish-American War, the Philippine Insurrection that kind of followed in 1898 to 1902, we actually had, shockingly, one of the first document exploitation operations run by the U.S. Army. We sent a Captain Taylor into Manila, and they set up a Manila manuscript archives project, and they collected the documents of the Philippine insurgent groups, multiple groups, plus documents left behind by the Spanish fleet. He worked very diligently on those documents. There's a lot of information coming out of them. In 1902, he came back to the States, brought the collection back to the Bureau of Insular Affairs, and they said, yes, great, do a contemporary history. Let's see what we can learn on this. Well, the problem is it ran into a political issue because of the Governor General of the Philippines was now running for the President of the United States. And the stories and studies of what the insurgents were saying about what the U.S. was doing, accusations of war crimes, actual evidence of war crimes, interesting politics of insurgent groups talking to anti-colonial political movements inside the United States, which you can imagine the politics of that during election season, got to the point where the entire collection of documents plus the analysis was suppressed. When the study was done in 1907, it didn't see light of day until 1972, when it was published in the Philippines. It's still never been published in the United States. So that got caught up. The gold standard for this kind of work, for most of you are aware, is post-World War II. With the documents captured with the collapse of the Nazi regime, and then the documents subsequently captured much lesser quality in some ways with the collapse of the Japanese Empire. Now, those documents immediately went into the typical intelligence analysis for ongoing military operations. They followed on very quickly with work in support of war crimes tribunals, both in the Pacific and European theaters. Went on for a few years. And then, interestingly, one of the very first uses of them was in the Cold War, was in 1947-48, when the State Department led an effort to put together the Molotov-Ribbentrop talks, which were well documented in the German documents, to kind of make one of the first early statements, international public statements of the Cold War about the nature of the adversaries, the nature of the international system that, as this new system was emerging in post-World War II, and captured documents were at the core of that issue. At the time, most of the documents were still in the hands of the Army intelligence and naval intelligence. By 1949, it was clear the expertise did not reside in the military. The Smolensk files is a great example. They were uncovered in 1945. The forerunner of the CIA, and the CIA held them until about 1950, and nothing was done with them. They were read, they were looked for particular information. Nothing. There's no real significant evidence that anything was done. It wasn't until they were turned over to a professor at Harvard with expertise in Russian studies that anything was ever done with the documents. It was because it went into this academic environment where the real value of them would come from. Now, there are some subsequent examples since then, very small collection from North Korea. There's Vietnam documents, which tend to be very tactical. There's the Grenada documents, which got some play, and the Panama documents. There's not much in those collections. I'll bring up one more. It's post-1991. We're talking about strange bedfellows in a way when you talk about, you know, DOD and some of the aspects of Minerva I've heard with some of the academic communities. There is no stranger bedfellow than Senate staffers combining with DIA field operatives and Human Rights Watch, which was the odd collection of people in 1991, between 1992, I'd say, and 1994, who brought a lot of the captured records that the Kurds, various Kurdish parties that captured northern Iraq, brought them out of Iraq. And then, again, you had this really bizarre scene of Human Rights Watch sitting side by side with DIA, translating and collating the captured documents, which resulted in some very significant reports and studies in the international community that are still used today as almost a baseline of the kind of totalitarian controls and human rights abuses that states can get into. So with that as a background, we've been here before. I've seen 5 years of working with these documents. None of the political issues, none of the hand-wringing, none of the challenges that have come up, either by the academic community or by the U.S. government, the intelligence community, which has certain sensitivities to these issues that haven't been seen before. That's the good news. And the bad news is the issues are all still on the table and we get to do it all over again, but at least there's some background. This is also well laid out. These documents are considered state records in international law. You will not find in the collection that we're talking about what is defined as cultural property in accordance with the 1954 Hague and subsequent protocols to that. These are generally defined as state records. They're not. These are contemporary records of the state. And I can say, again, having looked at them, there's a lot of misinformation in the public discussions about what's in these records. The manuscript files, the historical manuscript files, of which there are phenomenal collections in Iraq, for the most part, as far as anybody can tell, survived the invasion, survived the subsequent, a lot of the subsequent turmoil subsequent to the 2003 invasion, but more significantly are not part of the collection in which the Minerva Project is sponsoring this activity. Now, a little bit about the collection specifically. In size, it's difficult to articulate this, but the size of this collection is somewhere around a million document files. And a document file is everything from a single piece of paper, like a buck slip, to Saddam, your mom called, call back soon kind of paper, to a 5,000-word study, I'm sorry, 5,000-page study of some particular aspect of military or diplomatic import. So it's tens of millions of pages. It runs across about 99 different categories. Obviously, it's got the miscellaneous category. Most of them are like military plans, diplomatic correspondence, foreign affairs, government communication. One of the things that's really significant in this collection that makes it unique historically is the media files. Iraq, fairly sophisticated government in the terms of the way it documented itself. Saddam had, dare I say it, the Nixon disease. If he liked to record his conversations for posterity, and they had them transcribed, but a significant, I'm sorry, several thousand hours of Revolutionary Command Council meetings were recorded. Phone calls, private meetings with the senior advisors, significantly meetings that I find the most interesting are the ones where Tariq Aziz is reporting back to Saddam in private conversation after his many, many international travels over 30 years. So if you're trying to get, I heard some of the discussion earlier, if you're trying to get a picture of what it looked like on the other side of the hill, historically you're left with documents and memoirs and all the vagaries that come up in historical research. In this case, you get this little snapshot in time. You capture the emotion, the anger, the confusion. You get it all in these little micro snapshots, which from the terms of fidelity and the ability to tackle some of the issues of political psychology and did they understand our message that we thought we were sending? And did we understand the message they thought they were sending? You can go through, and a lot of international relations theory can actually be tested now over a window of 30 years with a very consistent set of actors, if you look at the hierarchy of the Iraqi regime. So I think that's pretty important. And again, in that scale, I said about 1 million documents. 40 to 50% of it, from a broad historical point of view, is fairly specific data in the sense they're like personnel records, medical records of senior officials in the military, fingerprint files of people who went through various aspects. So you end up with probably 500,000 records, distinct records that would have a flavor for historians, political scientists. I'm not saying the other records aren't important, but as far as a broad contextual sense of what the regime was about, what they thought, what they understood, how they related to their internal dynamics in the international environment, it's very sizable. Again, tens of millions of pages of material and several thousand, over 10,000 hours of audio or video of the senior ministers in private conversations. I can't even begin to explain, in my estimation, what the value of that would be and the number of disciplines who could come together on trying to think through the utility of that. But at the end of the day, the 5 years of the work that Institute for Defense Analysis was sponsored to work on this material is a series of government research studies, some of which have been made public, most of which have not yet been made public, but will soon, it's very utilitarian. We started as a lessons learned effort, to answer the fundamental question, what could we do better in the future? What did we do wrong last time? What are the very practical aspects of what these records might mean to practitioners in government, in the military, in the intelligence community? But it's been clear to those working on us that we're barely scratching the surface, and the real value of these, just like they found in 1949 with the Smolensk records and other examples in the past, the real value of this is only going to be known when the intellectual capital of the nation is brought to bear. And as much as I'm proud of my government service and my service currently with a federally funded research and development corporation, the real intellectual capital of the nation resides in the academic and in the institutions of academia out there. So this project is about making that available. Now, real quickly, and I'll turn it over to the real experts here on the utility of this, is it's going to happen in three stages. Right now, we have a project, Institute Defense Analysis, is under contract to develop the method by which these records can move out of a currently government database, government-only database, because it is associated with an ongoing military operation. There are legitimately classified aspects of recently captured documents in the sense that there's actual operations associated with them. But for the most part, the records that I'm talking about result from the April 2003 collapse of the Saddam regime and backwards. Those records will be made available starting very soon through a process that we're putting in place. The intent is those records will be available at the National Defense University with all great hope that it will be under Patrick Cronin and the INSS, and scholars can come use those facilities and those records. For those who have thought about the actual content, there are some challenges with these kind of records, and I'm not naive about the risks associated with them. So there will be there will be no classification associated with them, but there will be some consideration from human research protection protocols that most social scientists have had to deal with in the past. I can tell you historians, are loath to actually deal with them, but they're going to have to get over it because there are practical issues associated with individual personally identifiable information in some of the records. But I got to tell you, in looking at the scope of this, that's the minority of information. The real value is information that does not fall under those protocols. And the real value of this, again, is to take the historical opportunity to not do what we did after the Philippine insurrection, to not do what we did after the Civil War, and become overly focused on what turn out to be historically trivial events, and take advantage in the time and space of today to take advantage of this material to improve our next future, if you will, the next series of events that policymakers have to wrangle with. So as quickly as I can do it, I'll be happy to answer questions later about more specifics.
Well, I can...